So you know what it's like to feel a little anxious, right? I mean, most of us do. But anxiety can also be crippling. It can make an ordinary choice, like window or aisle or ketchup or barbecue sauce, feel like an issue of life or death. Writer Daniel Smith talks with Anne Strainchamps about his new memoir called Monkey Mind.
Anxiety compels a person to think, but it is the type of thinking that gives thinking a bad name. Solipsistic, self-eviscerating, unremitting, vicious. My walks to therapy, for example, were spent outlining with great logical precision the manner in which my state of mind would lead me to complete existential ruin. A typical line of thought went something like this. I am anxious. The anxiety makes it impossible to concentrate. Because it is impossible to concentrate, I will make an unforgivable mistake at work. Because I will make an unforgivable mistake at work, I will be fired. Because I will be fired, I will not be able to pay my rent. Because I will not be able to pay my rent, I will be forced to have sex for money in an alley behind Fenway Park. Because I will be forced to have sex for money in an alley behind Fenway Park, I will contract HIV. Because I will contract HIV, I will develop full-blown AIDS. Because I will develop full-blown AIDS, I will die disgraced and alone. From free-form anxiety to death by prostitution in 8 short steps. Most weeks, I found that I could kill myself off before I'd crossed the bridge into Charlestown. This gave me half a mile to fully experience the ignominy of my downfall, to see my mother wailing like a Sicilian peasant over my lime-complected corpse, to see the rabbi eulogizing my unfulfilled promise, to hear the thump of dirt on unfinished pine, to accompany my 2 brothers as they rush home from graveside to pull the plastic wrap off the cold-cut platters and switch on the coffee urn. Meanwhile, mounting the hill to the clinic, near horizontal against the angle of ascent, I would do my best to weep, for cathartic purposes. These were pathetic attempts at weeping, the bleedy cries of someone who has wept himself dry, like an ape laughing. Sweaty with strain and agitation, I would try to manufacture bona fide tears, and always, always, I would fail. By the time I arrived at the clinic, I was typically so demoralized I could barely stand. I was 23 years old, and I looked like Nixon resigning the presidency.
Daniel, that sounds awful.
It wasn't good. It wasn't pleasant.
When did you discover that the anxiety you experienced might be significantly worse than what the average person experiences?
It was when I was 16. The book begins with this walk to therapy that I'm narrating in what I've just read. But that's just a prelude. The real narrative of the anxiety begins when I'm 16 and when I lost my virginity in a way that a lot of young boys, a lot of boys of 16, might find glorious and wonderful, but which I found disturbing. And this was to 2 older women at the same time.
Two at the same time.
And you'd think this is the great dream of a 16-year-old boy. I had been seduced by an older woman. And when I say older, I was 16. They were probably in their earlier mid-20s. And I had accepted. There was nothing forced about it, except that it felt as if I had forced myself somehow. And in the wake of this, for whatever reason, the anxiety that had been within me as a child and that had led me to have little phobias and little tics, but that had passed, that had come and gone and come and gone, really flourished within me. And the anxiety took on a kind of totalizing aspect so that every day was just a living nightmare, a living hell. In fact, my waking state was bad, but so was my sleeping state, because anxiety is completely unremitting and just vicious and continues 24 hours a day. That, when I was 16, was when anxiety really became what I knew to be a problem. Before that, it was just, like I said, it came and it went.
You had the good fortune to have a psychotherapist for a mother. How did she react?
Well, the good fortune, yes, in that she's educated about it, but the bad fortune in that, like most therapists, she went into the practice because she had personal experience with the problem she eventually became an expert in. So I could both blame my mother somehow in genetic terms and behavioral terms for being at the beginning of my anxiety, the progenitor of it. But I was lucky in that she knew what she was looking at.
I'm just thinking about how difficult this must have been for your mother. I mean, did you come home from that experience with the 2 women and tell your mother all about it?
I told her about it immediately. It was humiliating. I had gone away upstate to see a concert, and there was a woman I knew who seduced me and who went and picked up another woman. And we had this night of debauchery. And 24 hours or so later, I returned to Long Island and walked into my childhood home. And there was my mother on her bed folding laundry. And I collapsed. I just imploded, and I told her everything that had happened and wept, and she said, you were raped, you were statutory raped, and she was so angry, she wanted to hurt these women, she wanted to arrest these women. And that turned out to be almost worse than the anxiety itself, which was the shame of knowing that a day or two after losing my virginity, I told my mother about it and cried. It was awful. I was so ashamed.
It sounds so difficult.
I'm very sad, Anne. It's a very sad story, but I feel much better now.
You make the point that everybody experiences anxiety, just not to the degree to which some people do. What's the dividing line, do you think, between ordinary kind of existential anxiety and pathological anxiety, like what you're talking about?
It's hard to say. I'm not a diagnostician. I'm not a theoretician. A lot of time has been spent trying to figure out in mental disorders where the line is. And usually it's a very practical one, which is when it goes on for a while and starts interfering with daily life. I mean, anxiety is ubiquitous. It's not just an existential concern, but a universal and evolutionarily necessary emotion. If we didn't experience anxiety, we'd get hit by cars a lot more than we already do while crossing the street. We need to be able to experience that state of kind of nervous vigilance about threats. But it crosses the line. I know when it crosses the line. When it crossed the line for me was when it became persistent and seemingly inextinguishable on a daily basis, and when it interfered with my ability to have relationships. I think that more and more these days, the more I go around and talk about anxiety and think about it and correspond with people about it, the particular hell of anxiety, of chronic, of acute anxiety, disordered mind, for me is when you could no longer love another person because you're so consumed with yourself and with your own thoughts, when you can no longer see anything outside of yourself. That's when, to me, anxiety becomes truly a problem, when it interferes with normal human interplay with relationships. But again, I'm not a doctor. I'm just a neurotic who writes.
That happened in your own life, right? With your girlfriend, Joanna, who you later married, but that relationship, you sort of destroyed it the first time around.
I did destroy it the first time around. We were living together in Boston, and my anxiety was so bad that I both wanted her and very much did not want her. When you're anxious, you're desperate. You see threats all around you. And in your desperation, you look for the sources of your anxiety. Of course, the sources are your thinking, but you look for external sources. And often you look to your loved ones. And I thought, I'm anxious because Joanna is around me. I'm anxious because I'm not happy in this relationship. I'm anxious because I am embarrassed and ashamed about being anxious and having this woman who I care about, who I want to see me as a strong person, seeing me as weak and quavering and miserable. So I pushed her away. But at the same time, when you're anxious, you want comfort. You want to lay your head in somebody's lap and have them stroke your hair and tell you everything's going to be all right. So a certain pattern emerges that you can see in the love lives of historical figures who really suffered from anxiety, people like William James or Franz Kafka or Soren Kierkegaard, the really great intellectual neurotics. They fall in love with someone and they proceed to push them away and pull them back in this awful sort of tango, this awful dance, until the object of their affection is just exhausted and can't go on anymore. And that's what I did.
You write about the worst moment, the exhausted moment for Joanna, I guess, happened in Venice?
Happened in Venice, in a beautiful pension overlooking the Grand Canal, when she noted that I was no longer saying that I love her. Because anxiety, of course, breeds, like lice, breeds doubt. And you can't be sure of anything. And she said, you haven't said that you loved me in so long. And I said, I'm not sure that I do. And she began to throw things at me. Rightfully, luckily, the only thing at hand were rolls of toilet paper. So I escaped pretty much unscathed physically. Emotionally, I felt awful because it wasn't that I didn't love her. It was that anxiety at that level makes a person incapable of love. I really believe this. Anxiety is so self-consuming, locks you so much into your own thoughts, into your own mind, that you just can't. You just can't love another person. And at the same time, you know that you can't, and you grieve for that. You're aware of your shortcomings as you're experiencing them and hurting other people, and it's awful. And shortly thereafter, she dumped me and was right to do so.
Though the story has a happy ending, and clearly Joanna is a formidable woman because she eventually took you back and you're married.
It was a few years later and we were apart and didn't talk very much. And in that time, I learned some skills. I learned for the first time that I could mitigate my anxiety on my own. I could learn how to recognize the thoughts that were causing me anxiety and how to question those thoughts. I learned a little bit of mindfulness, and I learned how, because of that mindfulness, to wall off my anxiety from the people I love, so that when I experienced anxiety, I no longer said to myself, I am anxious, it must be because of the people around me. I was smart enough and experienced enough by then to be able to say to myself, I am anxious, the anxiety is within me, it is because of what I'm saying to myself, it is a habit of thinking, a habit of feeling, it is not because I'm around this person. So I built a kind of firewall between my anxiety and the objects of my love. Objects being a terrible way of saying it, in regard to the people that I loved and the people that I wanted to actively love. So by then I had learned a few things. I was still anxious, but I just knew a little bit better. I was wiser.
Daniel Smith is the author of Monkey Mind, a memoir of anxiety. He spoke with Anne Strangechamps.